Welcome to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. "27 miles off the western coast of San Francisco lies the largest colony of nesting seabirds in the contiguous United States, the Farallon Islands, which is now a protected site where humans aren't allowed to go. But 175 years ago, the same location was treated as a personal egg buffet for hungry newcomers to the peninsula. Today, the Bay Area radio-making team, the Kitchen Sisters, take us back to the 19th century gold rush, when food, especially protein, was scarce in San Francisco, and where men were ready to die in what would go down in history as the Egg War.
When the egg pickers went in for the first time, they would smash every egg. That way they could be assured that the next day when they returned, every egg gathered would be fresh.
The Kitchen Sisters present The Egg Wars.
The Farallon Islands are probably the most forbidding piece of real estate to be found within the city limits of any city in the world. My name is Gary Camilla, journalist and author. The Farallons are part of San Francisco, but they're 28 miles outside the Golden Gate, in extremely turbulent, dangerous seas. They rise right up out of the ocean where there's no reason for them to be.
Originally, they used to be down in the Tehachapis in Southern California near Bakersfield and have been grinding their way north on the Pacific Plate about a quarter of an inch a year, about as fast as your fingernail grows.
Completely isolated, haunted by great white sharks, sea lions, and an enormous bird population. It's all filled with talus and rubble, this skeletal quality to the Farallons, like San Francisco without its skin.
The islands look like a piece of the moon that fell into the sea. My name is Mary Jane Schramm, Gulf of the Farallons National Marine Sanctuary. There really are no shores where you can land a small boat except with great perils.
My name's Peter Pyle, Farallon biologist. The island fills up with about a quarter of a million seabirds, gulls, cormorants, murres, auklets, storm petrels.
The largest seabird rookery in the contiguous United States.
Suddenly, within a period of 5 years, between 1849 and 1854, hundreds and hundreds of people came west seeking gold.
This incredible migration flooded into San Francisco. People from all over the world. It was a combination of casino, campground, dumping ground, and brothel. Early on, some shrewd 49ers began to realize that there was more money to be made in mining the miners than there was in mining the gold fields. Dozens of crude eating joints. They'd call them in, the gong would ring. Hundreds of voracious miners. Eggs was one of the foodstuffs that was in such short supply.
It's a protein-hungry town. The few existing chickens in San Francisco had been utterly devoured, so people are foraging.
I'm Ava Crisanti, illustrator and writer.
After you wipe out all the bird nests on shore, then you go out to the Farallons.
Doc Robinson was the first entrepreneur to begin the egg business. Robinson was a pharmacist. He sailed out to the Farallons and hauled back these murregs, selling them to restaurants and grocery stores. Gathering the murregs was tough, dirty, dangerous work. The murres laid their eggs up on these towering, steep cliffs higher than Nob Hill.
Doc Robinson takes his brother-in-law, Orrin. They're able to poach $3,000 worth of eggs. He had no interest in going back. It was a hellish experience.
This bizarre egg business that Robinson began helped kick off a egg rush.
The common murre was the most sought after, most delectable of the eggs out there.
Murre eggs are about twice as big as a chicken egg.
My name is Keith Hansen. I illustrate birds. The white of the egg when you fry it. It stays clear and gelatinous, and the yolk is deep reddish, very unappetizing to look at.
My name is Peter White, author of The Farallon Islands, Sentinels of the Golden Gate. In 1851, six men formed the Pacific Egg Company. The company claimed exclusive rights to the islands. In May, when the birds first begin to lay, the company would land 10 to 30 men on the island.
They'd row in on these little rowboats, which itself was a test of stamina.
The people that went out to gather the eggs were described as lowlifes. The newspaper people seemed to have a prejudice against the Italians and Greeks that mostly made up the egg pickers.
There they were, sending their men up to these sheer, guano-stinking cliffs, being attacked by swirling gulls. And these were roughneck guys, waterfront types, climbing up, pushing eggs into their special egg pockets.
When the egg pickers went in for the first time, they would smash every egg. That way they could be assured that the next day when they returned, every egg gathered would be fresh. In the early 1850s, 500,000 eggs were gathered a year.
The eggers started coming out about the same time the Lighthouse Society commissioned the first lighthouse at the Farallons. They've got hundreds of these ships coming in response to the gold rush, and a lot of them crashed on the Farallons.
Being a lighthouse keeper in the Farallons was severely lonely, harsh duty. And then they had to contend with these raucous, aggressive eggers. Rival eggers would sail out and challenge them. One man in particular, David Batchelder, just kept showing up with his own bands of roughnecks. The Great Egg War of the Farallons took place just a few weeks before the Battle of Gettysburg.
On June 3rd, 1863, three boatloads of heavily armed men came to the island, and they even had a cannon with them.
Batchelder and 27 other armed men appear. The guys in the egg company yelled out to them, "Land at your peril." Batchelder said, "I'll land. I'll go through hell." Then he and his men spent the rest of the night drinking. They got themselves into an aggressive, alcohol-fueled state. The egg company warned them. Then they opened fire. The guys in the rival boats returned fire.
The first casualty was one of the egg company's employees, Edward Perkins, who was shot through the stomach and died.
The guys in the boats, five of them got shot, and they were driven off. Finally, the federal government ruled all commercial eggers off of the islands. After that, any egging was done by the lighthouse keepers. Black market trading, trying to line their pockets with eggs. For decades, it was said that if you ate any baked goods in San Francisco, you were probably eating mer eggs.
When chickens finally got established in Petaluma, that's what ended up doing in the whole mer egg industry.
The Farallons are now used by scientists who observe bird and animal life. They are tracking the recovery of these species. It's a robust population now, despite the best efforts of the Farallon egg gatherers.
In 1969, the Point Reyes Bird Observatory began working to protect the Farallons. The islands had been through a lot. The devastating fur trade of the 1800s, the egg wars. During World War II, the islands were used as a secret Navy installation with over 70 people living on the island. From 1946 to 1970, nearly 50,000 drums of radioactive waste were dumped in the Farallon waters. Fishermen often shot high-powered rifles at sea lions, and helicopters were causing whales and other animals to panic. Today, only a handful of scientists, maybe five or six, are allowed on the island at a time. It's a sanctuary. The Farallon National Wildlife Refuge, managed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. When we began working on this story, we were given permission to travel to the Farallons on one of the supply runs that goes out to the islands two times a month. On board were scientist Pete Worsbach and interns Rosa Cox and Daniel Johnston. Roger Cunningham was our skipper on his sailboat, the Selkie.
This is my boat, the Selkie. She's a 36-foot Freedom cat sloop. I'm a member of what's called the Farallon Patrol, a group of volunteers who have boats that volunteer to take equipment and people out and back. Take all their food and supplies and their backpacks and then all their scientific equipment, everything, because there's nothing there. They do catch rainwater, but everything else has to be, you know, boated out and boated back because they can't leave anything there, even their compost I bring back.
We're moving up the estuary towards the Bay Bridge between Alameda and Oakland.
I figured out a couple years ago that I had spent cumulative hours-wise about a year and a half staring at MERS.
How long have you been going out?
This is my 16th season going out. I started as an intern back in the 2000 field season and got hired on as biologist the following year. So I've spent a lot of time on the Farallons. It's wild. It's full of life. This summer season, there's over 350,000 birds breeding on the island. Everywhere you go, you hear them calling, you see them flying about. Even when you go out at night, the Cassin's auklets and the storm petrels come back in the evening, and then you start hearing a whole different suite of calls at nighttime.
Going on the south edge of the potato patch.
The potato patch. They say a ship lost its load of potatoes here during the gold rush days.
Kind of a rough spot here, but we'll be through it shortly.
We saw an enormous mola mola float by, a sunfish.
That's Point Bonito.
They get as big as a Volkswagen, someone said. Strange, primitive, flat, round discs floating on the sea, one eyeball looking up at the sun, one fin straight up like a little sail.
I'll come back around.
During the egging days, there were estimates of up to 1 million MERS breeding on the islands. And they had these big, specially designed shirts that had a large pouch in the front. Think of a kangaroo almost. As they walked around on the cliffs and scared the birds off, they would pick up the fresh eggs and stick them in their pouch to carry them back down. That population of close to 1 million MERS that were there when they started, they knocked down to only a few thousand birds. Now we have, you know, just under 300,000, and that's the highest it's been since the egging days.
Pass out in the recliner.
Is there a library of movies?
We do. We have an eclectic collection of VHS and DVDs. Yes, we still have VHS.
So what's on your movie lineup out there?
Jaws.
Jaws.
And birds.
Yeah, it's time. Now the birds are getting aggressive. It's time to go watch the birds again. I first saw it when I was a little kid, and I was terrified. Now I work with gulls for a living, and I realize how funny the movie is. But it is interesting to watch it and then go outside into the gull colony, and they're attacking you. It's pretty intense.
A lot of turmoil here.
It was gray on gray out there, as far as we could see. Then suddenly, the devil's teeth popped up on the horizon.
Watch the movement of the boat, and when it comes up, step into it, and it'll drop.
In order to get onto the island itself, you have to climb out of the sailboat.
Step over and stand on the outside of the rail.
And into a small Zodiac that's lifted by a crane onto the island.
Just follow me.
It's a tiny little raised boardwalk trail that runs from the cliff's edge to the lighthouses. Everywhere you look, there's a gull on the ground, guarding an egg or a fluff ball of a chick. The gulls are dive bombing and intimidating. The birds rule here. No one messes with them or scoots them away. That's why everyone is wearing hard hats and hoodies.
Well, you know you're legally in the city of San Francisco right now. The true Western edition. Spent over 1,600 days out here.
All these little guys have numbers.
Yes. The first two numbers are the year that bird was born. It was banded as a chick. 0512, which is the 12th bird from 2005 recruit to this plot.
We are in Sea Lion Cove blind. We are closer to the MERS than we are anywhere on the island. My name is Russ Bradley, and I'm the Farallon program leader for Point Blue Conservation Science. So this is the common MER. They're black and white seabirds that are about almost a foot tall. They have these short, wide wings that are excellent for diving. They propel themselves with their wings underwater to catch fish. When they come to land to breed, as they're doing right now, they do so in these large colonies where their territory is basically like about 4 inches. The birds are jammed tight. They're very close together. They don't build a large nest. They pretty much just lay their egg right on the ground, just tight body to body.
The gulls are very territorial. And this is historically where the huge fur seal colony was. This is why the Russians came. There were tens of thousands of fur seals here, and the island was probably mostly fur seals and MERS. They basically hunted them all to extinction. It took 150 years for the first pup to come back. They have over 1,000 animals now.
This was one of the lighthouse keepers' houses built in around the late 1870s, and they housed families of the lighthouse keepers who tended the Farallon Light.
Here we've got the journal that goes every single day back to April of 1968, and we've had biologists on the island every day since then. After dinner every evening, we write the journal, 4.5 decades of knowledge about change that has occurred on these islands. Most of our interns can look up the day that they're born and see what was going on the Farallons. What do we have here? Breeding seabirds. This is in 1990. Oyster catcher fledglings. We've been able to look at how some of those populations were really affected by some of the major oil spills in the 80s. We've got whales, how many animals reproduce, when their chicks hatch, the condition they're in. These are all indicators that help us judge what's happening in this amazing dynamic ecosystem. We record dreams that have to do with the island. It's such a dynamic place. So many unique sounds and noises at night. It's a very intense experience. People are working very hard. They tend to have very vivid dreams. There's a lot of dreams that are anxiety dreams. People are thinking that they haven't done something properly. Dreams about a whole duplex house washing up on the island, lots of school children running wild. There are incredible island invasion dreams. I think those dreams really play to the sense of our continued mission to protect this place, the Farallons.
The Egg Wars is part of our latest season of Hidden Kitchen Stories, Kimchi Diplomacy, War and Peace and Food, produced by the Kitchen Sisters with Nathan Dalton and Brandy Howell, mixed by Jim McKee. The islands now constitute the Farallon National Wildlife Refuge, managed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We thank them for their support. Special thanks to Melissa Pitkin and Point Blue Conservation, and Doug Cordell and the San Francisco Bay National Wildlife Refuge Complex.
You can subscribe to the podcast The Kitchen Sisters Present on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Radio Public, or on whatever other podcatchers you prefer. You can also listen to episodes at kitchensisters.org. You're tuned to The Spot, KALW's weekly showcase of the best stories made by indie radio and podcast producers. I'm Ashley Ann Krigbaum. Now let's point ourselves west and head full steam to the coast of another Pacific island located off the southern shore of South Korea. On Jeju Island, a community of women dive for pearls, a tradition that's centuries old. They use a language of songs to communicate while they're diving, and the breathing technique they utilize to make these specific sounds is a skill only taught by mothers once their daughters begin their pearl diving training. Artist and filmmaker Mikhail Karikas brought the songs and stories of these women to the shore of the Thames River for an audiovisual exhibit displayed in Wapping, London in 2012. Here's Karikas speaking with radio producer Sophia Saldana about his time spent with the diving women of Jeju.
the Whopping Project podcast. Whopping and its stories, told through sound. Sea women.
When you're in the depths and you always push yourself, you want to hold your breath just a little bit longer, a little bit longer, because you see, you know, more shells and you see more food that you can collect. If you're tempted to do that, that could be, that 1 second or 2 seconds could lead to your death. They produce this incredible sound, very high-pitched sound, when they emerge out of the water, which makes them sound like dolphins or birds. So the women and their community and their profession are marked by this specific sound. It's like a signature of their community. Creating the installation here at the Whopping is very interesting for me. It's the first time I'm actually creating such a large-scale sound installation which is customized for this exact space. The main space of the exhibition has, in a way, some people would think is empty. So you go in and it's empty, but you are immersed in sound and you get a very specific story. It's the story of a day at work of the hangar. The community and the culture is such that you can't just go and visit someone uninvited. So I had to, it took a long time, I'd say months, before I was able to really have direct contact with the women. But then once they trust you, they give you everything. So I was able to be in within their camp. They cooked for me, they sang songs with me there, they lent me one of their bathing suits, so I was able to go diving with them. They took photographs of me because they found me, I realized, exotic. You know, the kind of fascination that I had with them, it was kind of turned back toward me. They have very interesting songs, and the songs contain stories, you know, real stories, or they tell of their passions or different parts of the culture. Iodosana is onomatopoeic, believe it or not, meaning that the sound, the combination of sounds, Iodosana, corresponds to an action, the sound of a particular action. Now, when I asked my interpreter what it means, he had no idea, although he's from the island. And it's the sound of rowing. So when the women go on the boats and they row, the sound of that, according to them, is Iodosana. I'm not pronouncing it correctly, probably, but it's incredible that that's, you know, the creaking of the wood and the sound of water is within that word, which is not really a word.
I'm
The island of Jeju has a very specific history and is very connected with a kind of reversal of gender roles. So the women would go and dive rather than fish. And that was, until the 70s, was a very profitable profession. So the men would stay at home, very often looking after the children. Also, women's work wasn't work. It was not recognized as a form of labor. They went against, you know, with the local tradition and this kind of conservative culture in many ways. Also, they fought for workers' rights and equal pay for women in the early 20th century. There isn't a feminist discourse that they are aware of. This is just self-generated and self-motivated. I spent about 3 months altogether on Jeju Island, and I had various encounters with the Henya and interviews. And numerous times I asked them, why don't you teach your daughters to do what you do? And their response was, well, we do what we do so that we generate money to send our daughters to university so that they don't have to do what we do, because it's a very hazardous, very dangerous and tiring profession. Also because it's no longer lucrative, you know, they don't make a lot of money because of industrialization.
That was the artist and filmmaker Mikhail Karikas speaking of the sea women of Jeju Island, the focus of an audiovisual installation he displayed in Wapping, London in 2012. This interview was produced by Sophia Saldana for the Wapping Projects podcast, which you can hear more of on Apple Podcasts. Just search for Wapping, WAPPING, Project Podcast. See you later. That's it for today's episode of The Spot. You can find this episode and more at kalw.org. Look for The Spot under the Programs tab. If there's a podcast you recommend right now, let us know. Email thespot@kalw.org. I'm Ashley Ann Krigbaum. Thank you for listening. And tune in next week, same day and same time, for another episode of The Spot, only on 91.7 KALW.